Valspar Ultra starts at just $29.98 a gallon. So we've got you covered when your daughter wants to paint her room again after last year's masterpiece of a unicorn mural.
Dad, please.
Or when you realize that maybe you went too hard on the greige.
I miss color.
Or when you were sure you wanted a home gym, but your elliptical is currently hanging your laundry.
What about a home office?
Shop everything you need for your next phase with Valspar. Available at Lowe's. Price varies by sheen.
True crime today.
This is the ongoing story of a small Idaho town and its residents. A tightly knit community that hasn't seen a murder since 2015. An environment where one thought they could feel safe and secure. Until a quadruple homicide stole the lives of four young souls on a mid-November evening, leaving far more questions than answers. Where will the investigation lead, and how do we get there? This is the University of Idaho Murders podcast. Four killed, for what?
Welcome to today's episode of the program. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any episodes of the program or breaking updates. My name is Tony Bruschi. Today, a special show for you. We are going to be talking with Tracy Walder. It's one of the few women to serve in both the Directorate of Operations at the CIA and a special agent at the FBI. She's going to join us to talk about the case and give us some logistical insight as to how things work within those agencies, what we're seeing externally, and what may be going on internally on a case like this. But first, we're going to turn to a statement that was released just this morning on the investigation with Moscow Police Captain Roger Lanier. This is his statement. It's about 6 minutes long, and let's take a listen.
Good morning. My name is Roger Lanier. I'm a captain with the Moscow Police Department. I'm in charge of the Operations Division. And today is December 12th, Monday, and I want to give you an update on the King Road homicide investigations, at least the information that we have to this point. Over the weekend, investigators still continued to sort through numerous tips, calls, and online tips in regard to this investigation. There's been a lot of questions about the white car that we've been interested in. We're looking for that car because we believe through our investigation that that car was in the area during the time of the murders. And we also believe that the occupant or occupants may have seen something. They may not know they have seen something. So we specifically want to talk to them, and we want to know who they are and what they might know or might be able to contribute to the investigation. Over the weekend, investigators have sorted through and prioritized numerous tips. Some are tips that came in earlier and we've been working on. Other tips are new and are relevant. It's overwhelming sometimes with the amount of information that comes in on these tip lines. So our analysts have spent hours sorting through and trying to come up with the most relevant tips first for the investigators to follow up on. They have re-interviewed some of the folks we've interviewed earlier in this investigation to clarify information. Sometimes when new information comes forward, the people that we've spoken to beforehand may have new insight on that. So it does often seem like we're backtracking, but we're really just trying to get the most important details and the best timeline that we can come up with. We have literally an army of analysts who have been sorting through videos that have been submitted through the FBI.gov Moscow upload site. Those videos are from all over town, gas stations, and specifically the area around King Road. We've been trying to use those videos to garner new information. As you can imagine, there's hours and hours and hours of videos, so it does take a lot of time. I want to talk a minute about safety. There's been a lot of speculation about what is the safety to the public right now or the risk to the public right now. I would just like to add that we should always be vigilant. Certainly we should be vigilant now, but we should make that a way of life for us. We should always be walking with our head up, sticking to lighted paths, and walking in groups if we can. And in addition, letting people know when you've arrived home if you have not made prior arrangements. This is not an indication of a specific elevated risk, but something that we should be vigilant with just in our daily lives. I want to let everybody know that we are still 100% committed to solving this crime. There's a lot of information to sort through, and the information keeps coming in. And not all of the information is relevant, but you don't know if a tip is valid until you take the time to examine that tip and see how it relates to other information that you might have. We have teams in Moscow, Salt Lake City, and in Virginia, as well as other locations across the country. And we're prepared to do interviews and follow up on information at any point, anywhere. The ISP and FBI investigators, along with the Moscow Police Department investigators, includes dozens of analysts, tip line operators, and others, and they're working around the clock 7 days a week to sort through the volumes of information. MPD has detectives, support personnel, and a communications team to try to keep everything together, but it is still a daunting task. The FBI, their investigators are ready at a moment's notice at any place in the country to go conduct an interview should the tips and leads take us there. And the Idaho State Police has, besides working on the investigation, had several uniformed troopers in the area to help with safety concerns around the city and on the University of Idaho campus. And just a quick reminder, please stick to official news releases for information. Tracking down rumors and quelling rumors about specific individuals or specific events that may or may not have happened is a huge distraction for investigators and oftentimes is the result of social media propagation. And it is very, very frustrating to investigators and hard to stay on track. Finally, I just want to add that we do have a lot of information, and we are specifically keeping that information safe. We're not releasing specific details because we do not want to compromise this investigation. It's what we must do. We owe that to the families, and we owe that to the victims. We want more than just an arrest. We want a conviction. We owe that justice to Zanna, Kaylee, Madison, and Ethan. And finally, I would just like to remind anybody with information, you can call the tip line at 208-883-7180. And that is directly to the tip line office in the FBI. There's been some frustration about having to wade through the tip line, but remember, this is not the only investigation in the country. So please be patient. We want that information. Anything could break this open for us. And then also the email tip line is tipline@ci.moscow.id.us. Thank you for your continued patience in this investigation.
That's Moscow Police Captain Roger Lanier this morning in a newly released statement on the case. Let's turn now to our interview. Tracy Walder joins us. She's a former CIA and FBI special agent and author of the book, The Unexpected Spy. Tracy, when everybody looks at this case, we're looking at a lot of different pieces, a lot of different ways of life that people are going through. Everybody, or not everybody, but a lot of people have a good idea what college life is like, whether one went to college or not. Sorority life, a little bit different than just normal college life, especially with the Greek life and such. I know you in your life had spent some time in a sorority. Tell me, is there anything, and maybe we're not, but is there anything anyone is missing in terms of their understanding or the prism that they're looking at this through? In the Idaho murders case, that maybe the general public doesn't quite understand about the lifestyle of sorority life and how all of that works and interactions with others?
Sure. That's an interesting question. I haven't been asked that, you know, in the context of everything I've done with this. I'm actually heavily still involved with my sorority work with executive offices, and I advise local chapters. So I'm very much still a part of that life, if you want to say.
Sure.
You know, what I've seen a lot in regards to this case in particular, because we don't have obviously a suspect arrested at this point or even any suspects that have been named, mm-hmm. a lot of times what happens is in the absence of information, you know, people start to sort of go down these rabbit holes. And I think the same thing holds true with both fraternities and sororities. There is some secretiveness, right? Mm-hmm. Surrounding them and their rituals and what they do and what their point is and all of that. And so what I have seen that's been, you know, obviously frustrating is that this was some kind of a sorority or fraternity revenge, you know, kind of killing, which, you know, obviously I cannot speak for whomever the suspect is, but I highly doubt that it's a part of that. Yeah. I just think that in the absence of information, I do think that probably I would, again, I'm completely hypothesizing at this point, that, you know, Sigma Chi in particular, they're really going to be going through everyone who was in that house to sort of account for that, you know, 4.5-5 hour time gap, mm-hmm. Of Xana and Ethan. I believe they've already narrowed it down to decide that they actually probably were in the house, just maybe not around invisible to other people.
Okay. That I think is the big thing. When there's less information coming out to the public, people are going to start speculating and starting rumors and all of that. And that just gets utterly out of control. But that is a question, just kind of understanding the dynamics is what I like to do. It may not end up explaining anything or finding reason for anything, but it gives some context.
We have to remember why, you know, sororities, I can really just mostly speak to sororities, right? Were founded in the first place, you know, in the mid-1800s, late 1800s. It was all about being a philanthropic organization. And the vast majority, I'd say 90% of sororities are tied to some kind of philanthropic organization. Mm-hmm. Some are juvenile diabetes, some are run on McDonald houses, you know, those kinds of things. And so really that is like their main focus. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, I certainly had a good time,
sure.
You know, when I lived in my sorority house, but I actually was held to a pretty high standard of grades and things like that. And so I think it also explains, I think, just the fact of being 20 and 21, right? Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether you're in a fraternity or a sorority, explains, you know, people maybe not locking their doors, houses being party houses, people being so drunk that they don't hear people coming in and out of houses, right? Yeah. I think we all have to put ourselves back into how we were at that age. And I think, yes, obviously fraternity parties play a bit into that. I think just being in college in general sometimes plays a bit into that.
Yeah, I would completely agree. I think that a lot of people need to put themselves in those situations of sorority or not. You're not always the most aware of everything that's going around you, especially when there's that much noise and that life, it almost becomes white noise. You hear girls screaming, but it's not usually in some sort of murderous situation.
Right. I lived right next door to a fraternity house. My house was, gosh, maybe there was 6 feet between us and the house, mm-hmm. I wish. And I mean, the amount of boys yelling and whooping and hollering for really all hours of the night, quite frankly, like you said, you just kind of learn to sleep through it. I mean, right? You know, it's just...
Yeah, it becomes a white noise type of situation. What I found interesting, and maybe you can speak to this a little bit, is the lack of any of the students speaking out from the sororities or the fraternities. We're in this world where, you know, it seems a lot of young people, they don't have the filters that many of us had in previous generations, mainly because of social media, where they've grown up where everything is fair game to talk about. I am rather surprised that we haven't heard more direct interviews or anything like that from anybody just saying, yeah, I saw those two on the couch or something of that nature, just to confirm that they were there. Do you believe that there's something within those organizations or from the police saying, don't talk to anybody in a situation like this?
Yeah. So I thank you for also asking that question too. No one really has. And I think it's easily answered. Whether we think it's right or wrong is a whole nother story.
Sure.
I do think that, first of all, I think the police are telling them not to talk, obviously. Mm-hmm. I think that's just across the board. But I do think we have to remember, I want to say three of them were members of Pi Beta Phi. One was a member of Alpha Phi. And then you have Ethan, who was a Sigma Chi. Mm-hmm. I could be incorrect on that, but there's a couple different organizations in there.
Sure.
And the reality is they all answer to an executive office. These are worldwide organizations that have directives from their offices. And we have to understand too, that they don't want to open themselves up to lawsuits and libel and defamation and all of that. Mm-hmm. And so my best guess is they are being told by their executive offices, do not speak with any member of the media outside of being a police officer. And that's what they're being told. And they're probably being told that if you do that, you will no longer be a part of this organization. I don't think they're doing it to hide anything per se, but I think what they're doing is, because this is an executive, you know, worldwide organization, they have to listen to, you know, whatever their respective presidents are. I'm almost 1,000% sure that that is what's happening right now, only because we've dealt with legal issues before in my sorority, and that's typically what we do.
Do you believe the organizations themselves are cooperating with the law enforcement?
Yes, only, I mean, I've been in that same position, and we do have to cooperate, and they probably, I have a hard time believing that they're not, but they want to probably do it, because you also have to understand that they want to help their girls, right? And they're obviously going through a lot, I would imagine, too, right? And so I think that that's when you start bringing in the adults. So like for myself, I was my sorority's standards advisor, and that's probably the person who's handling this within the chapters. And those are mostly older adults that are there to basically help these young folks like navigate through things like this, that can open them up to lawsuits and things of that nature. And so they probably just want all that information coming from one person rather than 100.
Let's talk a little bit about the profile of an individual who would have done something horrible like this. Obviously, to the public, there's not a lot of information out there yet of anything of that nature. The only thing we've seen really is they're looking for a Hyundai Elantra. But they haven't really talked about what type of person may have done this. Is it too early to give a profile of someone like this, or do they not want to give that away if they are working with that in fear of, tipping someone off, saying, well, that sounds a lot like me and I'm the one who did this. I better run.
I think probably both. You know, I think some of it is also for prosecution reasons too, right? And so if you have too much information out there, if you are giving out too much what ifs, right, without something concrete, you have the potential then of then muddying a jury pool, right, a potential jury pool for a case, should the suspect be arrested and this go to trial. And then that gives this person leverage for mistrials, deals, those kinds of things. And I would imagine the state of Idaho doesn't want that in this case, and nor would the families, the victims' families, right? And so I think part of it is for prosecution reasons. Like when I was at the FBI, we always kept that information very close until, right, we were ready to fill out information and get an indictment and then bring someone to justice. And so I understand it's a frustrating thing, and I truly can't imagine how the victims' families feel. But I do think some of that is to ensure that when they do arrest this person, because I do think that they will, this person is brought to trial without any hiccups or any kind of mistrial issue. So I think that that's kind of one thing. But I do think some of it too is that, you know, perhaps they've narrowed it down to a suspect pool of 10 people. Again, this is all hypothetical, I just want to say. Perhaps they've narrowed it down to a suspect pool, right? Maybe not just one suspect, but maybe a few suspects. Like you said, they don't want any information getting out there for fear that someone will run away, right, or will slip through the cracks. And so I think that there are several reasons for holding that information so close to the chest, but I think those are probably the two largest.
One thing that I think has stood out to some people as maybe being surprising, and maybe you can speak to this from your experience with CIA and FBI, the DNA, that will likely play a role in this, in identifying who that individual is. Is there a reason that there really hasn't been a lot of requests from people within the circle of these individuals for giving that? We heard from the neighbor who had a lot of rumors floating around about him, and he immediately held his hands up and said, take whatever you want. Here's my DNA. Do whatever you need. Let's just show that I'm not this guy. But allegedly, as of right now, we haven't heard that they've been requesting DNA swabs just to eliminate others in this case as of yet. Is that odd, or is that just something that the general public doesn't quite understand the logistics of?
So I've also heard that, you know, just rumors that, you know, there's no DNA at the crime scene. I find that to be also strange, because I don't know how you have a crime scene that's that violent, right? Without the killer leaving some kind of DNA. And perhaps that's why it's taking so long for them to fully release and clear the crime scene, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I find it very unusual that in a crime of slashing and stabbing, right? I don't mean to be graphic.
Sure.
Some DNA wasn't left behind. I find that highly unusual. And so my best guess tells me that there is DNA there. And I would think, just as, you know, I remember at the FBI, one of our kind of mottos was over collect in terms of evidence, don't under collect in terms of evidence. And yes, that might mean a bigger headache, right, in terms of processing and all of that. But theoretically, it typically DNA is used as more elimination, quite frankly, than matching. And so it would be something that would be, you know, in some cases, DNA can take as much as 14 to 21 days to get analysis back. But the reality is I would imagine this is being expedited. And so I think you're probably looking at 6 to 8 days, right? So theoretically, all of that should have come back, 2.5 weeks ago or so? And so I do find it strange. But again, I don't know. Maybe they are just sitting on a ton of DNA swabs that they've taken that I have no idea that they've taken. But typically in law enforcement, you want to over collect. It's not up to you to decide that something is evidence, right? It's up to the science, really, to decide whether or not it's evidence. And so I would find that odd if it wasn't abundantly taken, or at least a warrant.
Sure. Do you believe, and obviously this is just speculation, and we're not pointing fingers at anyone, and I'm not even going to go down that road, but I'm just kind of looking at the logistics of how this case was handled. How much damage can be done to a case in that first 24 to 48 hours before the FBI got involved, before state officials got involved, and it was just that small department that really didn't have hardly any experience in a murder case? Or anything of this nature, is there a lot of risk? Could a case really be, you know, damaged or made it very difficult to continue forward with solid evidence because maybe things weren't followed as they should have been, or just for lack of knowledge on how to handle a case like this with local PD before the FBI came in the way that they investigated and handled evidence?
So I think, you know, some of the message boards and those kinds of things have been really harsh to local law enforcement. But I think I really agree with your statement in that they've never handled anything like this before. This is a very small police department, right? And I'm not excusing them, certainly not excusing them. They still should be trained. But I'm not sure that a lot of damage, quite frankly, has been done. Because if you look at like the O.J. Simpson case, for example, that was a case that was seriously botched, right? From evidence collection at the scene all the way really to the trial itself, right? Yeah. I don't know that that's the case here, because to the police department's credit, and I will give them credit for this, they threw their hands up and said, we need help. And I have to say that that's a huge thing. A lot of local police departments are not open to receiving help, and they don't have to be, right? This is a local crime. This is not a federal crime that occurred. So kudos to the department for asking for assistance. Now, could things have been contaminated, right? You know, with police officers and those kinds of things? Yes. But like we kind of talked about before, DNA collection is going to rule that out, right? Fingerprint analysis is going to rule all of that out. So I'm actually not as concerned about messing up evidence. What I am more concerned about is this giving a suspect or suspects a tremendous head start, if that makes any sense.
Sure. I mean, we are going on week 5 now. So, and obviously they know that there's a lot of attention here for whoever did do this. When you have something like that and all this information, and I guess the questions that they're coming out to the public with of, there's still more than a week now going, we're still looking for that Hyundai Elantra that we don't know the license plate to. We know it was kind of in the area. Is there more that they're not telling us about this Hyundai Elantra, or is it just grasping at straws going, we know there was one here for whatever reason. We knew that somebody saw an Elantra. Maybe it was on a Ring doorbell cam or something. Do they even know if that will lead anywhere? Is that a solid lead, or is it just a there was a car here, which in a college town, somebody parked late at night on a street doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot in most cases.
So this is, again, just me personally thinking right about the Sunday launcher, because I think if they did, they would have found it. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why this very tight-lipped police department actually put something out there, because they're like, hey, sleuths and whatever, help us. Right. Like, mm-hmm. we need help with this. So I do think that they don't know more necessarily than what they're telling us. But, and I think I've mentioned this before on some news services, what I think is more important than the Hyundai Elantra itself is the source of that information, which we actually don't know. I believe what the police have clarified, but, and I could be wrong, is that this was not information that came from, you know, the body cams of those police officers who were arresting those folks for public intoxication. This came from someplace else.
Yeah.
So what I want to understand is, you know, you mentioned earlier, is this a car that just drove by, right? A Ring doorbell camera or something like that. Well, to your point, it's late at night and I'm sure others drove by. Why are they focused on this car? Where did the focus mm-hmm. come from?
Yeah.
From this car. And I think that's what's more important about, you know, this working backwards, because there's clearly a bigger web that they have from which they got this information from.
When cases like this, and in no way am I saying anyone is trying to hide anything for anyone, but in your experience working with the FBI and the CIA, are there times where someone knows, you know, I think someone did this that I know, but there's hiding. There's let's push this person over here or move this person this way or that way, so they're not the attention to this case. Do you feel like any of that is going on in this case? And again, this is just speculation and I'm not aiming that at any one individual whatsoever.
Well, no, I don't think you are. In my experience, right, I can really only speak for my experience. I've never had anything like that happen. And I've worked some pretty high profile cases of some people that like would definitely create problems for people if they were locked up, right?
Sure.
And we've never, obviously, I have personally never done that, but I can't say it's never happened before because I truly don't know the answer to that, right? Mm-hmm. Humans are humans and we're all not perfect and we all do things that are probably unethical, right, at some point in our lives, in our career. So I don't want to say that that would never happen. I've just never experienced it because that's never happened to me at mm-hmm. both the CIA and the FBI.
And that's interesting to hear your perspective on that, because I think a lot of people, they watch a lot of movies, they go to that conclusion of, oh, there's a cover-up. There's not always a cover-up. Sometimes there's just lack of information.
And, you know, people are still going to say, you know, about me, they're still going to say, oh, well, she worked there. Of course she's going to, know what I mean?
Oh, we go to that level too. Yeah. There's always a new level of conspiracy.
And I totally understand that. I get it. Because when something's secretive, it seems fishy, right? That's just normal behavior. And so I get it, but I promise you I've never.
Sure. Yeah. And that's what I wanted to hear. Just your perspective on it from your experiences. And I get what you're saying, where one would go, well, yes, let's take it to the new level of conspiracy where everything, anything anyone says, it's the exact opposite, which that's not truly, I think, the world most of us live in. With something like this, obviously, they're trying to figure out a motive, which doesn't seem to, you know, everyone who's being looked at. And for the most part, in the circle, I think of the kids, their families, their friends. There's been a microscope on all of these people. And for the most part, at least publicly, most have alibis. Most have very logical alibis that can be proven. So it really rules out a lot of that. What type of person, you know, do we think we're looking at here? One of the, and I want to hear your opinion on that. I want to share something that I have been saying from the beginning, is this idea of an individual that may not necessarily have known them well, more so an acquaintance. The word incel is what I had been talking about, whether or not they were involved in online message groups of men who hate women and feel rejected by them. And, you know, they end up sometimes snapping and taking things out. But I'm wondering if that would be the profile of an individual who would do such a vicious attack like this. you know, almost missing a piece of their conscience, missing that empathy. We're talking sociopath or someone, you know, on the spectrum of those sort of antisocial disorders. That's where I've been going on this, in just speculation of who this might be if it's not somebody, you know, within the direct circle. In your opinion, do you have any idea, or would you have anything to speak of as to the type of individual who would likely have done something like this?
Sure. I don't think that it's somebody associated with the incel movement. You know, folks that are incels are typically, you're looking at the Buffalo shooter was an incel. They leave things like manifestos behind. They will kill themselves. Like, they want to be known typically. Mm-hmm. And they want their frustration to be known. And there's the incel movement in and of itself. It also has ties with anti-Semitism and hate and those kinds of things. And that's not what we're seeing here. These victims were for the most part Caucasian. And so I do not think it's someone tied to this like greater incel movement. Now, could it be someone who's sexually frustrated? Sure.
That's what that's kind of where I'm going with it.
But that's not someone those are two different things.
Okay.
Right. The incel movement is somebody who is like taking this oath to be voluntarily celibate, right?
Okay.
And is out to target racial groups, ethnic groups, women, because they blame them.
Yeah.
Right. For this problem. Whereas someone who's just sexually frustrated because they've been rebuffed by a woman is just someone who's sexually frustrated. Right. Mm-hmm. And so then that comes out in different ways. Some guys just get mad and go find someone else. Right.
Sure.
Other guys, though, you know, especially if you have sociopathic or psychopathic tendencies, will overreact to that rejection. But I kind of want to move away from the incel thing, because I think people don't fully understand like what that movement is, like, okay, in and of itself. And so I think with this, I definitely believe that this killer is a male, though some people disagree with me. I don't understand how you can kill four people and not be bigger, I guess, if that makes any sense. Now, I think that it's a younger male, right, under the age of 30, mm-hmm, most likely. And I do think it's someone that blends back into the community. Incels tend to be standoffish, mm-hmm, socially awkward, those kinds of things. And I don't know that this person is necessarily the life of the party, mm-hmm, right? But I do think it's someone who blends right back into society and no one knows the difference. You know, I do think it is someone who's clearly extremely cold, right? And extremely callous to obviously be able to do something like this. But I don't know that it's necessarily some complete social outsider.
Would we know if they have leads on DNA? Would they say that publicly by any stretch of the imagination? My thought process on this would be, if they do have good DNA evidence, maybe from underneath fingernails, or was it said there were some defensive wounds on some of the victims? Mm-hmm. So one would assume maybe they do have some DNA to go on. And if they run it through CODIS and other systems, if there's no matches, that would make one assume that they're not in the system. Do you think someone like this, again, we're going on a lot of speculation today, and we're just discussing this in much broader terms. Do you think someone like this has offended before, or would this be maybe their first one? I mean, the risk that they put themselves in, going into a home with six people, two people still alive, of being caught, was extremely high. They got away with it, obviously. But it doesn't necessarily speak to the profile of someone who is very calculated, unless, you know, they were super calculated and that's how they got away with this.
Right. So I personally do not think that this person is in the system. Now, that doesn't mean they haven't engaged in deviant behavior in the past, right? Mm-hmm. It just may not have been reported.
Sure.
And they may not have a record. And so, you know, because all that means is that their fingerprints were, you know, put into the system. So in that case, it doesn't absolve them of, you know, doing anything bad in the past. Maybe sure. They have, just no one said anything and they weren't caught. I, like you, believe that they have to have some kind of DNA of some sort. I personally do not think that anything has come back as a match in CODIS. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. And I think, because I think if it had, they would have arrested the person already, or at least put out a warrant, right, for the person's arrest if they can't find him. Because they would want the public's help in doing that. And so now I do think, into what we were talking about earlier, that's where all those DNA swabs will come in handy, right? You can start. And so I think that is probably the issue now. They're either having to go back and get DNA for people, or the person is long since gone and they're not able to obtain DNA from that person.
With an individual like this, is there, I mean, I suppose in any sense of the matter, one could say there's a risk if they're still out there, but do you think there's a risk on the campus of this character coming back and striking again? I know a lot of people, you know, they said over the weekend during the graduation, travel in groups, let people know where you're at. I mean, the analogy that I had made earlier, and this horrible, but it reminds me of the movie Halloween, where, you know, this person is out there lurking around. Do you think that is going on, or is likely this person long gone out of the area by now?
I don't know. I'm sorry to be so vague.
No, it's fine.
I think part of it is, it really depends on, and I, like I said, I have said this from day one, although some people have disagreed with me. I felt that this was a targeted attack. And so, yes, their targets, whomever they were, are not there anymore, right? But again, this is exceptionally deviant behavior.
Yeah.
I don't know what these folks could have done to possibly, right, all four of them, be killed. And so do I think that someone else on this campus is going to be the explicit target of this person? I'm not sure that this person has other targets in mind right now. I really don't. But I do think this person could show up at a party, be wronged by someone, or have some kind of a perceived wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And then go after them. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I don't think this person is hunting people for the thrill of the thrill kill. That's not what I think is happening, kind of like to your Halloween analogy. I think this person doesn't react normally to whatever rejection, whatever kinds of situations they're having. And so that's more the concern than them just hunting people down on the streets.
And with that being said, someone that can switch that quickly from blending in, but then feeling wronged, that's an interesting profile of an individual. I think all of us have dealt with individuals like that, not necessarily murderous in our lives, but we look at the guy and go, why are you taking it that way when someone said something to you and it's very off? Is that, with that, does this person feel any guilt for what they did? Or is it more so they have this attitude of they, you know, I'm not trying to sound cold here, but they deserved that type thing in their twisted way of thinking.
So that's a great question. My best guess, again, my brain does not work this way. My best guess is that they do feel that, you wronged me. Therefore, now they might feel guilt about killing the other people, whomever wasn't their target, right? I don't know. But I think that in terms of, I personally feel that if this person felt guilt, they would have been caught already because guilty people make mistakes.
Sure.
People who feel guilty make mistakes typically. And so I don't know that this person feels a whole lot of guilt.
With, obviously they're keeping a close eye on all the people within the circles of these kids. It would likely stand out if someone is missing suddenly, they moved over here, or they withdrew or something. I think there would be something there that stands out, not necessarily meaning that they're a killer. Many kids, I'm sure, are withdrawing and getting out of there just because the trauma of what happened on their campus does not make them the killer. But at the same point, I would imagine that would be being looked at. The fact that there hasn't been anything brought up of, well, so-and-so is now missing, other than unsubstantiated internet rumors, which we don't really have anything to substantiate anything with, making it unsubstantiated, obviously. Right. But something like that, could this be someone that really nobody knew? And they're not in the circles of these people whatsoever. Maybe they weren't even going to the school. Is that likely a profile of this individual, or do we think it's something that's more in line with it was someone who was around these people on a regular basis, somewhat, whether or not the kids knew them whatsoever?
Yeah, I think that I do not think it's someone that just randomly walked in there, right, and decided to do this. I don't. And the reason I don't is because I guess this is to Kaylee's father's point of him saying the killers didn't need to go upstairs. So this is someone that, in my opinion, knew the house. Now, I understand that this was a house that hosted a lot of parties, right? And mm-hmm. I don't know that all six of these folks who lived in this house knew every single person, right, that came to the parties. I've been to plenty of parties where there's people there that I don't know. That's typical college behavior.
Sure.
So it may not be someone who's in their inner circle, right? Mm-hmm. Which I'm guessing it very well may not be. But I think it might be someone who's within, you know, their fourth or fifth radius band, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Who has been to the house at least and knows where people are located.
Do you think there's any information to be found on the girls' cell phones? I mean, just knowing how, you know, kids that age use cell phones, it's more detailed in a diary sometimes as far as what you're going to find in about their life, about who's around them. One would think that maybe there would be some clues there, and maybe there are, and that we're just not hearing about it right now.
Yeah, I think that they've obviously already gone through them, in my opinion, to eliminate immediate suspects, right? Mm-hmm. You know, people that maybe texted them, "I want to kill you tonight," right? Like they've obviously done that.
Sure.
I mean, there's no question in my mind that that's what they've done. My guess is now they're taking it and probably building, you know, like social profiles of them. Okay. Like who's been in a lot of their pictures? Is anyone suddenly not in their pictures, right? And those patterns of behavior take a bit to develop. So that's probably what they're doing now. Because they've probably already gone through and looked at all the text messages, right? Looked at all the voicemails, all the phone calls, and eliminated all of those folks. They would have definitely had to have probably been through that by this point.
With Steve Gonsalves speaking out quite a bit, not so much this last week, but the previous weeks, was on many interview shows, expressing his frustration, and rightfully so. I'm a dad of a girl. I would probably be doing the same damn thing, even if the FBI and the police are saying, we got this. I would be the guy pushing it, you know, kind of in my mind would be holding the feet to the fire, which I'm sure is probably what's going through his mind. Is that a hindrance to the investigation, or is that a positive for the investigation with the way that he's been speaking out and saying things that sometimes the police come back and say, well, this has not been confirmed or that has not been confirmed. Yes, we know he said that. Does that affect the investigation one way or the other?
It's so hard because, you know, I'm the mom of a girl as well. And I do not know what I would do in a situation sure. like this and how I would act. And I really, some people are being quite mean to him. And my only hope is that they never have to understand, right, what sure. he's going through, because I have truly no idea. Some people, when they're in a situation like this, choose to clam up, right, and be very quiet. And some people want answers. And so, look, I do think him perhaps saying things that law enforcement has told him not to say could clearly hinder a case, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, law enforcement wants that stuff kept close to the chest for a specific reason. I don't know how much he really has divulged, to be completely honest with you. I think we all know that this was a targeted killing, and he really sort of like verified that. And so I don't think he's hindered it all that much.
Is there a positive where people are very focused on this and people, you know, I've heard the term being thrown around. Obviously there's a huge fascination with true crime, and these are people's real lives, and it mm-hmm. can come across as, you know, somewhat cold and callous to be interested in something that you're really truly not, you know, connected to. But that interest, does that help to keep things going, keep the momentum moving, the public interest in this? Even though there are the horrible accusations that get made on message boards and such, but the fact that there is so much interest, is that a positive for an investigation like this?
So I think it's actually positive in two different ways. I think it's positive in that the case doesn't go cold, right? Mm-hmm. If we're constantly talking about it, and even speculating is okay, you know, as long as we're not making, you know, doxing people,
sure,
and coming after them. I also think too, and just, this is an interesting perspective I thought about, maybe it was about 2 weeks ago. So I teach college now. I teach criminal justice. Mm-hmm. And my students were asking me questions about this. And the interesting thing is a lot of them, if anything, it's brought them safety awareness, which I know sounds so silly, but you know, we've all been in positions where we've had way too much to drink and go home and don't lock our doors.
Sure.
Right. So I think in a way it's brought that attention to them. And I think that that's actually a good thing as well.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Where we're sitting right now, obviously we're 5 weeks in, there's got to be some sort of stat or something, or just, you know, experience where we don't have anyone yet that's in handcuffs or been arrested, or, you know, they're not even expressing a person of interest in any way, shape, or form to the public. Where, from your experience in cases, you know, of the nature, is this something where we're likely going to get some sort of answers here soon? Or is this far in where we don't have anything likely to linger on for some time without anyone in the spotlight?
So I don't know about time frame, but you know, the FBI has their uniform crime reports that come out every year. And that's just basically crime data throughout the US, throughout various police departments that, you know, choose to report, which is a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember about 40 to 45% of homicides go unsolved, yeah, every year. Like that's high.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not to say that police are bad at their job. It's just to say that there's, first of all, unfortunately, a lot of homicide. And second of all, it's not as easy to solve as it looks on like Law and Order, SVU, and,
yeah,
you know, Criminal Minds and all of those kinds of things. And so that's just a hard and fast statistic that we know,
yeah,
right? But I have a hard time thinking, you know, when you have a very brutal crime, right, of this nature, four people, digital age, a bunch of 20-year-olds that I am 100% sure are all over their phones all day long, right? Cameras, all those kinds of things. I do think that this is going to be solved. I don't think it's going to be one of those, you know, unsolved cases. I think that in a weird way, and I know this sounds strange, there's almost too much evidence at this point. And there's so much untangling that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you spend a lot of time like laying out that evidence, right? You spend a lot of time going through that, and then you can start developing suspect patterns and different suspects and those kinds of things. And I think it probably took them quite a bit of time to really do that, more so than I think what TV makes it seem.
Sure. Sure. Tracy, thank you for your insight today on this case. It's been very fascinating.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Tracy Walder there, former CIA and FBI special agent and author of The Unexpected Spy, which you can get on Amazon or wherever books are sold. And that's going to wrap up today's episode of Four Killed for What. Thank you guys for joining us on the podcast. Please be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and long form programs as well discussing this case. We do greatly appreciate that. I'm Tony Bruschi. Until next time, for all of us here, thanks for listening to Four Killed for What.